Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now we're in depth with environmental journalist Elizabeth Colbert. In the 3 years since Ms. Colbert published her book, The Sixth Extinction, and won a Pulitzer Prize for it, birds and rhinos, reptiles, seals, and more have vanished. In the last 100 years, tigers and ostriches, leopards, bats, and donkeys are among the thousands of animals that have disappeared and gone extinct. What happens to our ecosystem when a Hawaiian crow goes extinct or a monk seal that lived in the Caribbean? Today, it's a conversation about why some animals are vanishing and what we humans are doing to and doing about our fragile ecosystem. I'm also interested in how Elizabeth Colbert thinks about writing about science in such an absorbing and enlightening way. So as she joins me in the studio this morning, I'd like to hear from you. I'm wondering if you've seen changes in the plant and animal life in the places that you live and in which you travel. Are you curious about the fate or future of a particular animal or plant? So if you've noticed these changes in the area in which you live, maybe some of the places that you've gone, I think it would be interesting to have your experience inform our conversation. And if you're curious about the fate or the future of a particular animal or plant, you can call in on that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Elizabeth Colbert is a science writer for The New Yorker. She's the author of that Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction. She speaks tonight at the U of M's Northrop Auditorium, but she's in the studio with me this morning, and it's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You talked to scientists for your book about this idea of the Anthropocene age? I know there's a lot of debate about it again today. Tell me why.
Well, the question here is whether humans have so altered the planet already that you could declare we are in a new geological time period. So the Anthropocene is a term that was sort of invented by the Dutch chemist Paul Crutzen, who's one of the people who saved us from ozone depletion, one of the chemists who discovered the properties of ozone-depleting chemicals. And that the term gained wide currency because it really seemed to encapsulate, I suppose, a lot that all the these huge changes that are going on between, you know, climate change and land use change, all of the ways humans are altering the planet on a very, very serious scale. And it became a formal debate in geological circles. Is this really, should we declare that we live in a new geological epoch? And that debate continues, as you point out.
Is there something different within this debate about that's being observed about the way humans are leaving our mark on the environment? Because, I mean, you can go back to, 900 AD and see evidence of agricultural patterns that put a mark on the globe, right? So what's different, I guess, and being discussed in this debate on that?
Well, you've put your finger on one of the issues of debate, which is, let's say you decided that this were the case, that humans really are altering the planet in a way. So to alter the planet on a geological scale would mean to alter it in a way where a million years from now, 10 million years from now, when the fossil record is created, it would still be discernible. So let's say you decided that were indeed the case. Then the question is, okay, when did that begin? And some people, there's an argument, as you suggest, that it began all the way back, 9,000 years ago or so, when humans invented agriculture, that already left a permanent mark on the planet when people started to, you know, cut down forest and plant crops. And then there are people who argue, no, it's really not until the Industrial Revolution that we really laid down this permanent mark.
Do you think, doing the work that you do, that there is value in declaring a different age? Does it get people's attention? Is there something that, in the way that it may change the way scientists work?
Well, I think that it's already had that value, the term. I mean, we're talking about it right now, and it has gained, as I said, fairly wide currency in the scientific literature and even in popular culture. So I think it's already had the effect of getting people to think about things in a slightly different way, which is exactly, I believe, what Paul Crutzen had in mind when he came up with it.
Call here from Travis in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Travis. Something you've observed.
Hi. Yeah, well, I remember when I was a kid, and I'm only 42 years old, so it's not that long ago, monarch butterflies were all over northern Iowa, northeast Iowa. And I really honestly can't remember the last time I seen one.
Oh, that's very...
I was just wondering where they all went to.
Thanks for the call. Elizabeth?
Yeah, that's a very, very sad situation. And the caller is absolutely right that monarch butterfly populations have been crashing. And one of the, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out, can they sort of be brought back up? And one of the culprits really seems to be. So to everyone in Iowa, to all the farmers out there, you know, huge, you know, monocultures where monarchs have nothing to eat. They like milkweed. That's what they eat. So we really need to be leaving. You know, people talk about how in the old days, as it were, you know, people left hedgerows where, you know, milkweed continued to flourish and monarchs could use that as a food source. But now as we just, you know, mow down and really plant, you know, just huge tracts without any break, monarchs have nothing to eat. So, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service groups like that are really encouraging people to plant milkweed. You got to plant the right milkweed and to leave it there where it is so that monarchs have something to eat, because one of the big problems seems to be that on their incredible migration that they make, that they have nothing to eat.
You know, Elizabeth, see, just in your answer there, I think this is a way to bring what seems like a really hopeless and monumental dilemma down to a point where, you know, individuals, not to be too, you know, Pollyanna about it, but individuals can make a difference in your own environment. Tell me what you'd say to that.
Well, I think that, in, you know, the idea, are you personally going to save the monarch butterflies? You know, probably not.
Right.
But you multiplied by 1,000 and you multiplied by 10,000 and you multiplied by 1,000,000. Yes, quite possibly. So I think we have to imagine ourselves, as with all forms of action, ethical, you know, action. It's not me personally, but it is a matter of doing the things that if everyone else did, that you, modeling the kind of behavior that, you know, you wish other people were also modeling. And then over time, this multiplicative effect will have a tremendous impact.
Just the note here on you saying, and you have to plant the right kind of milkweed, because Sandra on Twitter says, in South Dakota, monarch butterflies are scarce these days. I had to try out milkweed seeds to gardeners, and many rejected as nasty stuff. So you have to know what you're planting.
Yes, and there are varieties of milkweed. You know, there are that you have to plant the variety that is native, you know, to this area.
Okay. To the phones to Meredith in Sioux Falls. Hi, Meredith.
Hi.
What are you thinking about?
So I just have a couple of comments. In the past probably like 4 years, we've actually, in my area, we have seen an increase in the bald eagle population, which has been pretty cool. But besides that, my other thing is in my part, so I live in the south part of the city, and over the past like 2 years, I've noticed these black squirrels, because our squirrels here are like brown. And I've thought about it a little bit, and I've come to maybe some possibilities, whether or not it's been like a dominant genetic mutation, or did somebody have it as a pet and release it, or like, are they just from maybe more rural areas and have moved in? I'm just curious if you guys have any thoughts on that.
Bald eagles.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you, Meredith. Bald eagles first, Elizabeth.
Well, bald eagles are a really wonderful success story of conservation. And this is a case, the return of the bald eagle is really related. This goes back to Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and warning about the effects of DDT, which had a devastating effect, not just on insect populations, but as Rachel Carson pointed out, on a lot of other creatures, including eagles whose eggs were affected. And so you just weren't getting viable chicks. And since we've banned DDT effectively in this country, bald eagles are now making a comeback. I share the caller's experience. I recently saw a bald eagle near the Hudson River, near where I live on the East Coast. And they're magnificent animals, as everyone knows. So they are making a comeback, and that's a wonderful thing. As I said, once again, proof that, you know, when you do the right thing, animal populations are often very, very resilient. As far as the squirrel question goes, I'm afraid I'm not an expert. I don't know if we're talking about, different varieties or even different species of squirrels, or if we're just talking about a genetic mutation. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Elizabeth Colbert is with us this morning. She's the author of The Sixth Extinction. It won a Pulitzer Prize and brought, I think, a lot of the research to our attention about what's happening with the extinction of different species around the world. And I'm asking you, as we tease out some of the ideas in the book and in the reporting that she's been doing, if you've seen changes in the plant and animal life in the places in which you live and the places that you go, great questions so far on bald eagles and monarch butterflies. And if you're curious about the fate or the future of a particular animal, Elizabeth is not a zoologist, but she's done a lot of reporting for a long time. So I want to tap that experience as well, as much as we can. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Ian says he loved the book, Sixth Extinction. Where do mosquitoes fit into all this?
Well, thank you, Ian, on the book. Mosquitoes are fascinating creatures, to say the least. One of the interesting things about a lot of the mosquito-related issues, that problems that we're having, disease-carrying mosquitoes, you know, Zika, for example, being an emergent disease, is that people carried mosquitoes around the globe. So a lot of these, oftentimes, these disease-carrying species of mosquito that we're now very concerned about, those are not native mosquitoes. Those are mosquitoes that people brought with them as they traveled around the world.
You know, it occurred to me as I was thinking about our conversation, I Googled animals that have gone extinct in 2016, and I saw this list come up of creatures that I've never seen before, and now that I never will. And more and less from a scientific standpoint, but more from a wonder of the world standpoint. This is something I would imagine you think about, just philosophically, what it means.
Well, you know, people are often sort of, you know, there's this question, like, what's the value of, you know, a species? We don't even know, for example, we don't know how many species there are on Earth, and estimates vary pretty widely, perhaps by an order of magnitude. We've cataloged, you know, maybe 1.5 million species, but there are probably 10, 15 million species out there. So what does it matter if, you know, sort of one winks out? But I think that when you think about it, you know, really in a hard-headed way and also in a more philosophical way, every part of this equation, there's really no reason to imagine that, you know, one species is more valuable than another. Every species is here. Every species is a solution to the problem of existence. And when we get rid of one, we're sort of eliminating one of those solutions. So it's sort of like, you know, burning down a library, which we would think is not really a good idea. And certainly the rate at which species are departing this earth, and I would add, and I think this is crucial, departing it because of us. They are not departing it in the natural course of events, but because of things that humans are doing, is really a tragedy, obviously.
I think your comparison of burning down a library is excellent, because you may be aware of the, you know, the original manuscript of Shakespeare, you know, something like that, something that draws a lot of attention. But all of those books were built on foundations of other books that we may not even be aware of, but they have their place, right, in
right.
that canon, in
yes,
that library.
Exactly. And another point that's worth making, perhaps, is that, you know, the species that appeared on that list, that's the tip of the iceberg, as it were. The fact that we haven't cataloged many, perhaps most, of the species on Earth means that there are probably a lot of species winking out, you know, that we're not even aware of.
Call here from Chris in Palisade. Hi, Chris. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks. I just want to make a comment on, since I'm from northern Minnesota and I used to travel farther north into the northwest, I've noticed that there's been a significant loss in the moose up there. I used to see moose all the time out in, you know, and that's, you know, 100%, or not 100%, but 90% agriculture north of Crookston and Warren area. And they've all gone. But I want to circle back around and talk about the monarch butterflies, too, that I heard something years ago that when they migrate to Mexico, that there are a few specific forests that they ended up to, and that there was logging operations going on down there. And I thought that was one of the big reasons that the monarchs were taking such a hit. So I was wondering if you could touch on that.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and that's very true. The monarchs are a very... they're just a fantastic species. Anyone knows who's seen a monarch and who's seen their whole metamorphosis is just entranced by it. Excuse me. But yes, they winter in Mexico. They've been very hard hit by habitat loss in Mexico. And then they make this amazing journey here up into the U.S. and into the northern U.S. And that takes, you know, quite a while. And as I mentioned before, they need to eat along the way. So both of those factors, I think, it's unfortunately, as in many of these cases of, you know, severe decline of animal populations, it doesn't have just one cause, and unfortunately probably has several causes.
Elizabeth, Jay on Twitter says frogs. Many friends are posting audio of frog calls as they awake in the spring. If they go, spring will indeed be silent. I noticed there were a lot when I was looking at these lists of animals that are going extinct. I noticed there's a lot of frogs on the list. Do you have any idea why?
Well, yes, actually, the story of what's happening to frogs and other amphibians is really what set me out to write The Sixth Extinction, because amphibians are the most threatened class of animals right now. Something over 40% of the species that we know about are considered, you know, threatened in some way. And one of the big factors in the decline of amphibians is a disease, a fungal disease that was probably moved around the world by people who were importing some kind of frog. And scientists have done a lot of work trying to figure out where this disease originated and have had a hard time tracing it. But it suddenly popped up in a lot of parts of the world, which is very suggestive that it was carted around the world by humans. And it has killed off some of these most fantastic. If you look on the web, you can find really beautiful, beautiful frogs who are now no longer with us.
You know, when your book came out a few years ago, I remembered reading something that Al Gore wrote about it in the Times. So I went back to look that up. And this is something out of that review that struck me. He said, extinction is a relatively new idea in the scientific community. Well into the 18th century, people found it impossible to accept the idea that species had once lived on Earth but had been subsequently lost. Will you add some context around that?
Sure. And that is a big part of the book, the sort of natural history, as it were, of the concept of extinction, which was discovered, if you want to call it that, by a French naturalist named Georges Cuvier at the very, very end of the 18th century, right after the French Revolution. And Cuvier, prior to that, as you point out, people had a conception of creation. You know, why would God put on the earth species that he then, you know, eliminated? It didn't make sense to people. And so they simply sort of refused to believe it, even though there was mounting evidence at the time in the form of fossils and things that are not quite fossilized, but, you know, mammoth teeth and mastodon teeth, that there were creatures that we just couldn't find anymore. And this French naturalist, Georges Cuvier, sort of cut through that argument and said, well, they're simply gone. And that is one of these things. It was actually a concept that caught on pretty quickly, but one of the people who resisted it, interestingly enough, was Thomas Jefferson. And when Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark to, you know, the West, he very much hoped that they would find live mastodons roaming around because he basically refused to believe that they were extinct.
Elizabeth Colbert is in the studio with us if you've tuned in. She speaks tonight at the University of Minnesota at 7:30. I'm sure details on the U of M's website. But our conversation right now is about the reporting experience and the research that she drew on for her Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Sixth Extinction. And I'm asking you, well, we've got full phone lines at the moment, but when we open some lines up here, asking you about what you've observed about plants and animals in the places in which you live and you travel and the future of those plants and animals. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Nora in St. Paul. Hi, Nora.
Hi. And so I wanted to touch on the bald eagle populations rising, which is certainly a success story. But bald eagles as the national bird and being a nostalgic symbol have a lot of added protections. And I know at the lake that I grew up on in East Central Minnesota, we also had a blue heron crane rookery. And since we've seen the bald eagle population rise each spring, we see the bald eagles raid this rookery and really decimate the baby birds. And we've seen a steep decline in blue heron cranes on the lake. So I'm just wondering about false protections, and are those detrimental to other species, and how do we keep that balance?
Good.
That's a really good question. And, you know, we are tinkering is too mild a word. We are so putting our hand on the scale here of, you know, what survives and what doesn't, that doubtless we are making a lot of mistakes along the way, you know, and what the world looked like or would look like without our interference is a really interesting question. And obviously, you know, eagles have probably, you know, been eating the chicks of many species for a long, long time. But as you point out, as the caller points out, you know, when you give one species very special protection and not the others, you may well be creating other problems. And we see that over and over again. I'm afraid I can't comment on this particular situation. But it's certainly a huge issue in conservation.
I think Nora also raises that question of the mythology that we attach to certain animals, as with the eagle, as with polar bears, and the short shrift that other, as we've established, very essential parts of the ecosystem. Do we just kind of have to live with that? We're going to be excited about polar bears and we're not going to be excited about six frogs that have gone extinct. What's the counterpoint to that?
Well, I think that the big lesson of, if there is a lesson, you know, to be extracted from the efforts of, you know, thousands of individuals and many laws and lawsuits is, you know, we should really be thinking on a very broad scale, landscape scale. You know, people talk about landscape scale conservation, and we need to be conserving whole ecosystems. And when we do try to bring back, you know, one part of an ecosystem without the others, we do get, you know, really skewed results, and perhaps results that we don't like, and perhaps results that are more damaging than nothing. Now, in the case of, you know, the bald eagle and getting rid of DDT, I think it's hard to argue that that wasn't a good idea. Many bird species, especially, you know, many raptors, were really badly affected by DDT. I don't think anyone would say, okay, well, some people might say it, but for the sake of birds, I don't think anyone would say bring back DDT. So now, you know, as that ripples through the system, you may get some results that you don't like. Now, whether you can do anything about that, whether you should do anything about that, those are really tough questions.
We have, you're probably aware of this, we have a big bee research center at the U of M, which is fantastic. Rebecca in Grand Rapids asks, can you talk about the declining bee population? What's happening? You've done some reporting on this, right?
Yes. And there's two issues here. One is what's happening to honeybees, who are not a native species to North America at all. They're a European species, and they are, you know, bred and carted around the country by beekeepers to pollinate our crops. So they're an important agricultural species, but they're not important to our native ecosystems. And they have been suffering from this sort of mystery ailment, which to this day, we do not have a clear cause for that. Now, then there's another issue, which I think is becoming more and more prominent and getting more and more attention as well. It should be, which is the decline of our native bees. The first bumblebee was actually recently listed. One of the last things the Obama administration did before leaving town was to list the rusty-patched bumblebee as an endangered species. So we're now seeing the decline of our native bees in the U.S., and that has potentially huge ramifications because, obviously, bees pollinate flowers. You know, that's a long, long-running evolutionary dance between bees and flowers. And without our native pollinators, our native plants are going to be in big trouble.
And by the way, this comes back to something that you talked about earlier about milkweed. I mean, it's not all that difficult. You know, I don't know how much my neighbors love all the clover that grows in my yard. They probably don't love that. But it swarms with bees. So I know it's a good thing. So you can do something individual.
Right. And people, you know, there is a big movement in this country, and I think it's a great one, you know, to plant native plants. We spent a long, long time importing, you know, very showy, beautiful flowers to our country from other parts of the world, you know, from the tropics and from East Asia and all sorts of places. And that has had, you know, very dubious effects, both in terms of bringing pests into this country that we didn't want, and also in terms of depriving our native insects of the flowers that they need. So planting a native garden is a great thing to do.
I just read your piece in Smithsonian Magazine about the DNA scientist on elephants. So Elizabeth Colbert is with us. We're going to talk about that, the profile that she did about this DNA science that is tracking down ivory that is taken from elephants. I have a question on Twitter about what's happening with West African lions. And if you've just tuned in, Elizabeth Colbert is with me in the studio. She's a science writer for The New Yorker. Her book is titled The Sixth Extinction. You might remember it won the Pulitzer Prize, and she speaks tonight at the U of M at 7:30. So your calls and your questions welcome. If you can get in on the phone line, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Phil, what are you leading with this hour?
Hi, Carrie. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin's meeting yesterday with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson produced no immediate positive shift in relations between the two powers. Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the Russian leader gave Tillerson his view of the roots of the current deadlock and bilateral ties. President Trump yesterday said U.S.-Russia relations may be at an all-time low. This morning, Trump tweeted things will work out fine between the USA and Russia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe warns North Korea may be capable of firing a missile loaded with sarin nerve gas toward Japan. Abe's comments to a parliamentary panel in Japan on national security come amid looming concerns about another missile or nuclear test by the North. The two women accused in the poisoning death of the half-brother of North Korea's ruler have appeared in court in Malaysia. Their attorneys say police still have not handed over security camera footage and documents crucial to their defense. Kim Jong-nam died 2 months ago after the women allegedly smeared on his face a banned nerve agent while Kim was at a crowded airport. The Libyan Coast Guard says 97 migrants are missing and believed drowned after the Europe-bound boat sank on a perilous crossing of the Mediterranean Sea. Spokesman Ayub Ghassim says 23 migrants were rescued around 6 miles off the coast after authorities received a distress call. The boat was loaded with African nationals. And Pope Francis goes to a maximum security prison today to wash the feet of 12 inmates. The Vatican says Holy Thursday is a good time to stress that a pope must serve those on society's margins and give them hope. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:35.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, Republican Representative Tom Emmer joins me as we check in with members of Congress while they're on a two-week recess. We'll also discuss this week's report on the tens of thousands of Minnesota children suspected of being abused or neglected last year. Join us at 11.
On Thursdays, I'm behind the mic for Indivisible. It's our public radio national call-in on the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Tonight, I talk about what it really means to be middle class in America. There's some new research on this. There's some really interesting responses about how people feel like they identify with the idea of being middle class. We'll talk about that tonight on Indivisible. It's at 7 o'clock. We'll hear voices from across the country, and I hope we hear yours too.
Programming supported by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community, home of one of the Midwest's largest green roofs, a biomass heat and power plant, an organics recycling facility, and other earth-friendly programs to protect our lands and waters for the next seven generations.
Programming is supported by the Guthrie. Coming soon, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. From the writer of Beloved and Song of Solomon comes a 1940s coming-of-age story. On stage 5 weeks only, beginning April 15th. GuthrieTheater.org.
Support for this program comes from Caulfield and Dix Patent Law, dedicated to helping solo inventors to large companies protect their intellectual property by practicing only patent and trademark law. With offices in Edina and Sioux Falls, more at TwinCitiesPatent.com.
I've got an evening coming up on May 16th at the Fitzgerald Theater that I really hope you'll put on your calendar. Princeton theologian and writer Eddie Glaude is going to be at the Fitz with me to have a conversation about income inequality and race and politics in America. He is dynamic and incredibly charismatic and persuasive. It's going to be an interactive discussion. It's May 16th at the Fitzgerald Theater. Tickets are available on the Thread or at the Fitz box office, and I hope I see you there. Back to the conversation this hour. And Elizabeth Colbert, by the way, if you want to see her talk, at the U of M tonight at 7:30. Let me grab a call here, Elizabeth, from Michelle in Maplewood. Hi, Michelle.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I happened to just pick up the book, and it's really great. The chapter that's really dramatic for me is the one on bats and the white nose syndrome. The one thing I wanted to ask on that is you mentioned that we think it came from Europe, but can you tell me a little bit more how that would have got here to us? And then secondarily, that chapter is so like terrifying and tragic. How emotional do you get when you are kind of doing the research on this? Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks again. That's a really it's a really good question. So the bat story is a story once again of a disease that was transported around the world by people. And in the case of the bats, it's been traced back to Europe. This is also a fungal pathogen. By scientists doing genetic analysis. So the reason, the way it came to the U.S., well, no one really knows is the honest answer, but the speculation is the very first record of this syndrome, white nose syndrome, comes from a cave in upstate New York. And it's a cave that, you know, cavers like, but it's very close to a cave that thousands of people visit, House Cavern. And so the speculation is it was probably just brought over either by a caver or a tourist, you know, in dirt on someone's shoe or something like that. And the problem is that it has now spread bat to bat, you know, all across, halfway across the U.S. It was actually also recently picked up in Washington State. So it has sort of jumped all the way over to the West Coast. So it's a huge, huge problem. Many millions of bats now have been killed, and no one really knows what to do about it. As to the second part of the question, you know, how emotional does one get? It's a very hard question to answer. I mean, it's just sometimes overwhelming how sort of sad the situation is. And in that particular case, I actually saw, you know, this sort of carnage of the dead bats near where I live, up in Vermont. There's a big cave where bats, hundreds of thousands of bats used to hibernate. And I went there right after white nose hit with some Vermont scientists, and there was just a carpet of dead bats on the ground. And that was, you know, not only unbelievably sad, but to be honest, you know, also sickening. I mean, it was really, really awful and kind of gross. So it's not, there's not one answer to that question. One experiences every, you know, sort of every emotion out there, as I'm sure everyone who's thought about this issue does.
But then you have the experience of doing a profile on a scientist, as I said, having read this in Smithsonian, who is actually creating a system, I hope, that will intervene in the poaching of elephants for their tusks. So that's a hopeful thing.
Well, that you're referring to a guy named Sam Wasser, who works out of the University of Washington in Seattle. And what he did was he realized that he could make a map of elephant genetics using their poop, using DNA that you could extract from poop. He made this map so that he can now tell you, if you bring him a sample of elephant DNA, within a couple dozen miles, where that elephant is from. And that has had the effect, when there's a seizure of illegal ivory, which unfortunately there are all the time now, he takes samples of the tusks, elephant tusks are really just big teeth, and gets DNA from that and matches it against his map, and he can tell you where that elephant was poached. And what he has discovered in the process of this, and I should also say, and probably most of your listeners know, that elephant poaching is a huge problem now. The population of African elephants has declined by roughly 95% over the last century. And elephants are truly in danger of extinction if we don't do something. It's sickening.
Mind-blowing.
Sickening.
It is.
And poaching now in most, in virtually all African countries, it's not legal just to mow down an elephant, but poaching is a huge problem. Ivory still fetches a huge price on the black market. So it's very lucrative. And Sam traced most poaching that's going on to these two sort of poaching hotspots, and it has put a lot of pressure on the governments in these countries to try to do something. And I think it's also put pressure on our government, to be honest, and on the Chinese government. Most ivory is bound for China these days. So maybe there's a glimmer of hope there. Certainly Sam is someone, he's a great character, really driven, really, the kind of person who doesn't sleep because he is so driven to get something done here and realizes that there's just not a lot of time.
We should have him on the show.
He
would be an interesting interview.
You absolutely should.
Done. To the phones to Andrew in Spicer. Hi, Andrew. Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. Say, just wanted to touch base. I definitely believe animals are going extinct. But what are the checks and maybe some double checks that experts are taking to actually ensure that the species are going extinct? Because there has been examples of species that they claim are extinct and, some years later coming down the road, they find out they are not. So,
that's a really good question. And the sort of official, definition, as it were, of when, if an animal is extinct, is it hasn't been seen for 50 years, which is a long and very rigorous, check. So sometimes you're right. People say this animal is extinct, and even maybe it hasn't been seen for 50 years, and then a tiny little population will pop up. I think that it is a good point that you're making, in a sense, which is, extinction is the end of a long process of population decline, usually, or maybe a quick process sometimes. And we should perhaps focus less on extinction than population decline. And when we look at those figures, people who are just tracking populations, we also, not tracking whole species, but just populations, we see also a lot of, unfortunately, really bad news of populations across all sorts of species, all sorts of groups of animals, declining very rapidly, in the course of the last couple of decades.
Ted asks Elizabeth about your thoughts on the ethics of resurrecting extinct species.
Well, that's a really interesting question, and this idea of resurrecting extinct species and de-extinction has gotten a lot of press recently. It's, I think, because it's a cool idea and maybe a hopeful idea in a sea of sort of bad news. But I'm going to sort of be perfectly honest and say I think it's really a sideshow to what's going on, and that's true for two or maybe more reasons. One, we actually don't know how to do it. There's a lot of talk about it, but no one has actually successfully done it or even come near to doing it. And two, you know, if you could do it for a couple species, very, very labor intensive, fine, you know, money intensive. Meanwhile, all these other species are going extinct. Meanwhile, the habitat into which these animals would be placed has disappeared. That's why they went extinct in the first place. So you're really not solving any of the serious problems here.
This is the other question that I wondered about, which is most of the extinction happening because there is direct human intervention in the habitat, whether it is from poaching or from, or is it more of a macro thing of that involves the way the climate is changing? I know you're going to say it's both, but which do you think is most directly responsible for this?
Well, I don't, it's not just that I'm going to say it's both. It's that I'm going to say, I don't think we know.
Okay.
But another thing I will say is if you look at extinctions that, you know, that we know or that we're fairly confident using, you know, the 50-year test that have occurred, actually one of the biggest drivers are invasive species. So species that we brought often to islands, which are often laboratories for interesting evolutionary innovations. Many islands, for example, had no sort of mammalian predators, let's say like foxes or rats. We bring them over sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, and that just decimates island populations. So one group of animals that's been really, really hard hit in the last couple of centuries has been birds that are endemic to islands, especially flightless birds. You can imagine a flightless bird is a sitting duck, as it were, for any kind of predator that's introduced. So schlepping things around the world, you know, just bringing animals around the world, as I say, either intentionally or unintentionally, has been a big driver of extinction.
I know you're watching climate policy and what's happening under the Trump administration. I'm just going to ask this straight out. How much damage can an administration that pulls back a lot of regulations on climate do in 4 years? Because you're used to looking at very wide swaths of time and effect. So I want kind of a reality check on this.
Well, it's a really good question. And I think that, you know, as an experiment, the Trump administration seems intent on showing us the maximum amount of damage that an administration can do in 4 years, because they are really, I just wrote a piece about this for the New Yorker's website. They are really, they don't seem to be able to do much in a coherent or focused way, but they are really going after environmental regulations. And you will see the impacts of that, you know, absolutely, you know, in the Great Lakes, all sorts of places out, you know, that will affect Minnesotans. And so I really urge Minnesotans to, you know, rate their representatives and that sort of, you know, basic civics thing. Now, in the grand scheme of things, you know, it is the case that climate change is a global problem. Emissions are global. They're cumulative. You know, they add up in the atmosphere. So, you know, the damage that the Trump administration is going to do, we're going to you know, emit that much more CO2 over the next 4 years than we would otherwise had they left the regulations in place. Over the vast scheme of things of history, you know, it will be a relatively small blip.
Which doesn't mean that it's insignificant. And I'm
exactly.
Certainly not saying that, because I think it absolutely is. But I also try to put it into some kind of historical perspective, as
right,
you've done.
Right.
Shannon says on Twitter, heard that orangutans will be extinct in 15 to 30 years due to habitat loss from palm oil demand. Is that right?
Orangutans are another, you know, just absolutely heartbreaking story. And yes, that's basically correct. What happens is orangutans are confined to a very small area right now, and they live in the, rainforest, forests of Indonesia. And what happens is that companies come in, really just mow down these forests and plant a monoculture. Once again, we're talking about monoculture agriculture that goes on for, you know, acres and acres and acres of just palm oil. And palm oil is unfortunately ubiquitous in everything, you know, from soap to, you know, cookies, Girl Scout cookies. And so there are lots of people trying to work on, you know, sourcing palm oil, no more deforestation to palm oil. You know, let's leave the forest that still exists, relatively small bit, but let's leave it and not destroy it for palm oil. But, you know, that's a tough fight.
I wanted to ask you about writing about science in the kind of enlightening but really absorbing way that you do. I had a conversation about this with Helen MacDonald. You probably read H is for Hawk.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so she does very different writing than you do. But I'm really interested in how you think about telling the stories the way you do in a way that it's absorbing and it makes an impression. It changes minds. It does.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that people often make sort of a distinction between writing about science and writing about everything else. I don't really. You know, I started my journalistic career covering politics. And
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
For way long, back in.
Yeah, in the dark ages. Yeah.
Who was president when you started?
Yeah, should I acknowledge that?
Okay.
You know, I think that all of these, in a lot of ways, the task is the same. I mean, when you cover politics, there's a group of people that are sort of on the inside and they speak a certain lingo. And it's almost impenetrable to people on the outside. And the job of a journalist is to try to make that understandable and interesting to the general public and to, you know, just people, lay people. And the same is true of science. There are different challenges. You know, some science is really, really, really hard. And I am not a scientist. And I find that reporting can be very, very difficult. It's just scientific concepts that are hard to get your mind around. But the basic point that, you know, there's an interesting story here and you've got to do the reporting to sort of dig it out. And also you've got to do the writing to make it comprehensible. Those are the same challenges of all sorts of reporting.
Do you think most of the day-to-day science reporting is good?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, most day-to-day science reporting is off of, you know, scientific papers, to be honest, you know, and scientific publications have also gotten very good at pushing stories they know will interest the general public. So I think that you will get, you know, a lot of interesting stuff. Now, some of that are, you know, discoveries that are made. They're fairly, you know, incremental, I guess I'd say, and they might turn out to be contradicted later by other studies. But the basic stuff that you're getting, the basic information that you're getting, I think is pretty good.
Elizabeth Kolbert's book is called The Sixth Extinction. She speaks tonight at 7:30 at the U of M. I'm really grateful you made some time to come in and talk.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me.
And thanks for grabbing all the calls and answering all the questions.